Okay, we're on page 25. And we'll pick up around questions 8 or 9, somewhere in that area, puts us in the 10th chapter, around about verse 25. So Hebrews chapter 10, and page 25 in your folders. Okay, we were talking last week, starting in verse 19. We have verses 19 through 25 at least going together, and this puts us just out of a quick review. Questions 1 through 4 on page 24. The privileges and the obligations of being a disciple. Here were the privileges. These were these phrases we see in the text in verse in chapter 10. Since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, verse 19. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, verse 21. Then the obligations were, these were the three let us phrases, as you remember. Let us draw near with a true heart. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. And then this is the point we were finishing up with last time. Let us consider how to stir up or to provoke each other to love and to good works. Takes us down through the 24th verse. And so, very familiar text in Hebrews 10 about verses 24 and 25, talking about how saints were to stimulate or to provoke other saints. And we do that, the subject matter of these verses is by our assembling. So we want to talk about that just for a few moments. We did look at this was the last chart we looked at last week. The incentive for disciples is to hold fast, or the incentive to hold fast is the faithfulness of the promises God has given us. And the practical way to do that is to assemble with fellow believers, verses 24 and 25. I didn't specifically ask this question, but I want to take just a couple of minutes and talk about a couple of words. To me, it's always helpful when you're studying a certain passage of Scripture is, does the Bible use this same word somewhere else? Helps us kind of get an idea of what's really behind that particular term, that particular word. We are to provoke each other to love and to good works, or to stimulate, some versions may say. Look at a couple of examples where this same word is used in the New Testament. Turn to Acts 17. Verse 16 to begin with, Acts chapter 17. This is the chronicle of Paul, if you will, on his journey. He gets to Acts 17. What city is he in? He's in Athens, Greece. Of course, this is here where he preaches that great sermon on the Areopagus or Mars Hill. Look at verse 16. Now, this is before he even starts preaching. Ralph, what does it say about Paul in verse 16 of Acts 17? All right, there you see the same word. So how would you describe Paul? His spirit was provoked. What's that mean? Roused. He was stimulated. He was stirred, urged on. He saw all this. I don't think he just could not keep quiet. I'm going to have to say something about this. That's the idea of being provoked. So it's not always in a bad sense. It just means that something, there's some incitement, there is some provoking, some urging, stimulating to do a certain activity. Also, look with me in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, verse 5. Another familiar chapter, all the attributes of love. Love does some of these things and love doesn't do some of these things that it's said. All right, tell me, what's it say about love in verse 5? Right, love is not provoked. True love, biblical love, does not provoke, aggravate in the negative sense, and aggravate or to irritate, I guess, maybe some other versions. Love does not do that. So there's some other uses of the word provoke. And so this is the same idea. We're told in this passage to stir up or to provoke other believers. Now, of course, that would not be to irritate or to agitate, but to incite them or to stir them on to their further faithfulness. Yes, right. Yes. Yes, context will always determine whether or not it's in a positive sense or a negative sense. Another good passage there about provoke, not provoking your children to wrath. Okay, now let's quickly keep laying my clicker down here. Now let's talk about this idea of forsaking. We are not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. And let's look at some other verses where this same word is used in the New Testament. Turn to Matthew 27 and the 46th verse. This, of course, will be the record in the Gospels concerning the crucifixion, trial, the arrest of Jesus, the garden scene, if you will, then the leading up to the cross. Matthew 27, we want to look at verse 46. No, that is not correct. Okay, yes. I'm looking at the wrong part of the verse. Thank you. Okay. This time Jesus is on the cross. Okay, now I'm with you now. And what are his words? Why hast thou for... Of course, he's quoting Psalm number 22. I was thinking, the verse I had in my mind was that the passage that all forsook him and fled. I had that on my mind. That's not what the verse is talking about here. But that will be another one. But this particular passage, that's what Jesus is saying. Why hast thou forsaken me? Also look at Hebrews 13, back in our Hebrews epistle, at chapter 13 and verse 5. Hebrews 13, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For what has God said? I'll never leave thee nor forsake thee. It means to abandon. It means to desert. It means to walk away from. Leave high and dry, if you will. And then finally, in Acts chapter 2 and verse 27, in the first gospel sermon, quoting David from the 16th Psalm, Acts 2, verse 27. What did the psalmist say? Because thou wilt not what? Leave. Some versions say abandon. Some versions say forsake. That's the idea. So we're not to, regarding our brethren, but this duty, we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves. We're not to walk away from that responsibility. We need it. We need it to be faithful ourselves, but who else needs us to assemble? According to this passage, our brethren need us to be here. So when I'm not here, if I choose to, now if I'm sick, if I've been in a car wreck, if something happens that is precluding me from coming, I need to make all attempts to make sure that I'm here. But if something precludes, then I'm not forsaking. But if I just willfully choose not to come, and I think that's the context of the passage, willful sin, deliberate sin. If I say, you know, I'm just not going to go today, I don't want to. Well, I'm abandoning my own responsibility, but I'm also abandoning my brethren. I'm forsaking them and how I can help provoke them to further faithfulness. So here's just a couple of ideas or a couple of other passages where these same terms are used to kind of give us a flavor, if you will, for how the Bible uses in particular words in the New Testament. So that's kind of where we left off last time. This takes us through the end of about question 8, I believe. Now we'll pick up with question 9, looking at some other passages before we leave Hebrews 10 here. All right? This need for enduring faith. We have to have not just faith, but a faith that endures. It goes all the way to the end. Why do we need to have such faith? Well, we're talking about willful sin, he says, the writer. Then says, after he says in verse 25, not forsaking or not neglecting to meet together, the English Standard reads, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more so as you see the day drawing near. We discussed in a previous class what this day is at the end of verse 25. I think this is the day of judgment. Some think this is the day of the first day of the week. I guess that could be possible, but I'm under the opinion, because of the context of the passage, we're talking about the day of judgment. As you see that day drawing near, do not put yourself in jeopardy of judgment, because that's the verses to follow. Talk about that. Verse 26. For if we go on sinning deliberately or willfully, after what happens? After we receive knowledge, after we've been taught, after we know better, if we sin willfully, when we know that's not the right thing to do, what's the writer say? What else can Christ do for you if you willfully sin? Nothing else to offer you. There remains no more sacrifice for sin. Is there such a thing as the sin of ignorance? Just to put in contrast with this phrase here. Is it possible to commit sin and you don't know that you're doing it? It can be. I don't think that list is as long as the other list, but I think you can do some things that you've not yet been taught about. Maybe you don't know that's not the right thing to do. Maybe that may be more prevalent for a newer convert. He's not taught, he's not schooled as much in the faith of Christ. He's got a lot of things to learn. And so maybe he'll do something that later he learns, you know what, I shouldn't have done that. I didn't know any better. Didn't know maybe that I offended my brother or sister's conscience, whatever those things may be. So there is such a thing as a sin of ignorance. But the author is not talking about that kind of activity. He's talking about willful, deliberate sin. And again, in context, I believe, the context of forsaking the assembly. I've heard some brethren say that they don't think verse 26, the willful sin under discussion, would be forsaken. I think the context demands that's what he's talking about. I don't think that's the only deliberate sin one can commit. I think there's others. There's a whole list of them. But I think this passage is talking about that. Going from the end of verse 25 right into verse 26 seems to be a nice, easy, smooth flow of thought there. Brother Lambert, you going to say something? Okay. Yes. Yes. That's right. Nothing else can be done for you since you've received the knowledge of the truth. Okay. Now, can someone deliberately sin and they've not yet received the knowledge of the truth? Well, that's possible. But what can be done for them? They can obey the gospel, can't they? And have all that guilt removed. They can do that. But if one deliberately sins after being taught, he knows the gospel of Christ teaches against such activity, but they do it anyway. What else can be done for that person? Now, they're going to have to repent. But what can be done for them? What can be given to them? That what's already been given them? Nothing that I can think of. But, I mean, they know the will of Christ, and they deliberately sin anyway. So we're talking about a situation where someone is putting themselves in grave, grave danger, grave jeopardy. And this gets us into these verses that I've already preached on in a previous lesson, verses 27 through 31. Talking to believers, we're talking to Christians, how dangerous it is to put ourselves in position to face God in this kind of predicament, being guilty of deliberate or willful sin. So, this willful sin results when saints do not endure through such faith. And again, chapter 6, we've already covered that previously, talking about those who would fall away. The passage that comes to mind in that chapter is that those who commit deliberate sin, what do they do to Christ? They re-crucify or crucify Him afresh. They put Him back on the cross, which is not a good thing to do, of course. So if we so sin, what else can be done for us? This is deliberate or intentional sin. This is not by accident. This is something that a saint has purposed to do. It is rejection. It's not ignorance. We're just telling God, basically, I don't care. I'm going to do this anyway because that's what I want to do. And it doesn't matter to me what your will says on the matter. So this is some hard-hearted things we're dealing with here, attitudes, mindsets, if you will. Now, I'm trying to tie all this together. Saints who are guilty of this, they're not going to enjoy those privileges that we've been talking about. Again, what were those two privileges? Well, toward the start of this context in chapter 10, we have confidence to enter the holy place. Will the one who persists in deliberate sin enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus? No. And does one who is deliberately sinning, does he have a high priest who's speaking for him? No. Christ can't mediate for such a one, can he? Not that we're trying to limit what he can do, but if we put ourselves in that position, how's Christ going to speak on our behalf when we won't even follow his will? That's not going to take place. So guilty saints will not enjoy these privileges mentioned earlier. Rather, they won't have that. What do they have to look forward to? Well, follow the context now, starting in verse 27. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving knowledge of the truth, verse 26, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but, verse 27, what do we have? We don't have that, but what do we have? A certain or a fearful expectation of judgment. I think some versions have the word certain in there, do they not? Yes, but a certain terrifying. So it's not a maybe. Well, maybe Christ won't be upset with me. Maybe Christ won't judge me in this matter. No, it's a certain judgment that you face. A certain terrifying expectation of judgment. And how are the words descriptive of this judgment in this verse? Fiery. Fiery indignation. Have you ever had anybody so mad at you that you could see the wrath and the anger on their face? You ever been the object of someone's wrath before? Maybe your wife or your husband, your parents, maybe you disappointed someone, and you could tell by the look on their face, this person's not really happy with me. So you kind of have to work through all that. Well, this passage is describing, we don't have these privileges, but we will have a fearful expectation of judgment, a fury of fire that will do what? Consume or devour the adversaries. There's no getting out of this. Did you get the idea? And I think I said this when we went through this in that sermon. Do you get the idea that the writer is trying to get our attention with some fearful language here? Absolutely. We need to pay attention to what he's saying. Of course, the audience to whom this book was written in the first century, they needed to know this. They were being tempted to go back, walk away from this, but we need to read it also as well. So when we commit deliberate, willful sin, let us pay attention to Hebrews 10. It needs to get our attention. Yes. That's a good point. Okay, so this is going to be a very consuming judgment that will devour the adversaries. Isaiah 26 and verse 11 is an Old Testament passage, I think, that comes to mind. Some marginal notes maybe reference you in that direction. I think, again, this is most likely the day that was mentioned back in verse 25. As you see the day drawing near, this day approaching, you're putting yourself closer and closer to judgment. You're outside of the will of God. If you're guilty of deliberate, willful sin, this will not bode well for you. You'll be caught unprepared at the day of judgment. Okay. Now, as he continues, right, God's fierce anger and His wrath is directed at and justified against the covenant breakers. Verse 28. Let's look at that. This is the Old Testament reference. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies how? Without mercy. That's the first point to consider. See, no mercy. And the second point to consider is how it's to be administered. On the evidence of two or three witnesses. So there was a procedure to follow. I think the writer is talking, at least it seems to me, one place to reference is Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 through 7. The context there dealt with idolatry. Moses even says, if someone comes to you, and I'm just going to paraphrase here, if someone comes to you and says, let's go serve this God over here, let's go worship this idol. That's the offer, the proposition. The law said, you're to take no pity on him, show him no mercy. You're to put him to death on the evidence of two or three witnesses. It had to be corroborated. It couldn't just be hearsay. But if it was to be corroborated and shown to be, that's what that person said, the law said, you put that person to death. You're to show no pity. Even who was to be involved? Even the person's own family was to be involved in stoning that Hebrew. No mercy. That's how serious God viewed walking away from the first covenant and going and serving some other god. So, although it doesn't say, and there doesn't appear to be any quotation here, this the author is saying, setting aside the law of Moses, dying without mercy on the testimony of witnesses, that is at least one occasion where you can go back and on, you can read, that's the prescription that the covenant of Moses dictated on that occasion. Now, that being the case, there's no maybe about that. Since that is so, what's the question he asks in verse 29? Okay, if that wasn't bad enough, and that was bad enough, then how much severer punishment are we going to get in this context of committing deliberate or willful sin? Well, what's the worst thing that happened to them in that context? They died physically. They lost their life. Well, how can you get severer or worser, if that's a word, more worse punishment than that? There we go. We're talking about eternal punishment now. Not just physical loss of life, but the loss of one's soul. And that's why it's more severe. Has this thought been introduced before about how the second covenant has greater blessings, but it offers more severe punishments? Yes, we've seen it before in chapter 2. Remember? When the writer was talking to us about the in the context of the humanity or the detour or the divine side of Christ, chapter 2, verse 1, we must give the more earnest heed or pay much closer attention to what we have heard, since the message delivered declared or delivered by angels proved steadfast, reliable, and every transgression received a just retribution, and it did. Then what was the familiar question? How shall we escape? We won't. So this thought has been used before, just worded differently now, but it's the same essential thought as back in chapter 2. So, that being so, this being the truth, then guilty saints today can expect a much severer or worse punishment. Now, I believe the author then goes on to describe, and this again was the main outline of the sermon we preached about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the guilty and their willful sin. How is it that God views the deliberate sinner, the apostate, not the person from the world, but the one who is forsaking his responsibilities and has turned his back on God? What three ways does God, where the Holy Spirit, does He describe such ones? Let's take them in order. The one who has spurned or trampled underfoot the Son of God. As we mentioned, that's the idea is to walk all over or to stomp on, to treat with great contempt. That's how God views us if we walk away from Christ, to walk all over His Son. What's the second one? All right. Blood is blood, isn't it? What's the big deal? Well, what had He already said in this chapter in verse 4 about blood? All right, it's not the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. So blood isn't blood. Now, they shed that kind of blood under the first covenant. But as we've already learned, all those things were a type. They were pointing toward the greater of Christ, the second covenant. But now those who walk away, they just are saying, well, Christ shed His blood, that's no big deal. Animals died. Any other human can die. All blood is blood. But no. Where that's just a profaning or regarding His blood as common. No big, special, important thing. So that's what we're guilty of as in terms of how God sees it. Then what's the third way He looks at us? All right. To do despite, the old King James says, or to outrage or to insult the Spirit of grace. Now notice again how it's phrased at the end of this section in verse 29. The Spirit of grace versus... Back in verse 28, they set aside the law of Moses, such a one dies without mercy. No mercy there. Under this covenant, there's a spirit of grace and mercy. It's available. And if we've answered that call, again, going back to verse 26, you receive a knowledge of that truth. You've accepted it. You've obeyed it. But then later you or I or whoever the saint may be may walk away from that. Then we're insulting the spirit of grace. No one likes to be insulted. Spoken evil against, spoken contemptuously to. We don't appreciate that. And how can we think that God can feel any different is beyond me. So, when you look at these three descriptive phrases, how big of a deal do you think God sees it? It's very important. He's highly, highly concerned about a Christian that falls away. And you do not have anything to look forward to except a certain fiery indignation, his judgment that will consume his adversaries. It's not a good place to be. Yes, Brother Lynn. Yes, the intention was to stone to death. You are correct. Not just cause injury, but death. Yes. Yes, chapter 12 talks about Esau. He despised his birthright. It was just a common thing. Remember how he reasoned amongst himself, I'm dying of hunger. What good is that birthright going to be to me? I'll be dead anyway. So he just traded it in for a bowl of stew or soup, pottage, if you will. So just taking something very special, very, very spiritually important and just saying it's just no big deal whatsoever. Okay, so these phrases, I think when you view them in context, they really declare something highly, highly important. And we need to pay attention to what's being taught here. So, go ahead. Yes. The old argument of situation ethics. Situation will determine what is ethical, right or wrong. What, you know, is it okay to do something? Well, you're right. Situation can get as bad as it can get. It will never, ever alter what God has said in His Word or what He expects of us. So we're talking about judgment. Now, this takes us through the end of verse 29. Okay, how much severer punishment, how much worse punishment will we get if we are guilty of these three statements that are mentioned there? Now, verse 30. For we know Him who said. Well, what has He said based on verse 30? Vengeance is mine. I will repay. And the other statement. The Lord of God will judge His people. So that is certain. Willful sinners, deliberate sinners, those who are saints, who have gone against the will of Christ, it is certain and is guaranteed. He will have His revenge. This makes me think in Romans 12, 17 through 21, how we're not to repay evil with evil, but repay evil with good. Why? Do not take revenge for yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is said. Same quotation. Revenge doesn't belong to us. Revenge belongs to the Lord. Not to get too sidestepped here, but why is that? Why has God told us that revenge is not ours? And it only belongs to Him? Okay, He knows more than we do. I tell you, people can be pretty cutthroat, can't we? If I lift revenge up to, if I've been wronged, and God said, "Now, Jeff, revenge is yours. You can repay until you're satisfied." what am I apt to do? Liable to go, I think I would go beyond. I think I would say, now look, I'm going to get my pound of flesh and then some. And then I'll tell you when I'm happy and I'm satisfied. And that just sets it back and forth. And then they can have revenge and I can, and it just escalates. But God in His wisdom, what can He know? That's it. That's enough. I'll enact the revenge. He's able to do that. So in this case, He'll have His revenge against those who walk away from what He's offered them. Now notice again, He's not talking about judging those who've never obeyed the gospel. The Bible does teach that, of course. There is a judgment. 2 Thessalonians 1 talks about those who will face the fiery presence of the Lord, who know not God and who have not obeyed the gospel. They will be judged too. But we're talking here again about saints who have fallen away. So vengeance is mine, and the Lord will judge His people. Then the last phrase in verse 31, what is it? What are we reminded of again? Right. It's terrifying to fall into His hands. Now, this is something that will just make us shudder. I'm living this away. I'm doing this. I'm failing to do this. And I've been taught this, and I know it's not right, but I'm doing it anyway. And so every day I live, I'm inching closer and closer to that day when I'm going to fall into His hands outside of being prepared, and it's going to be absolutely terrifying. We did mention this passage in that sermon in 2 Samuel 24, not to go back and revisit that again, but you remember when David took the census of the army, his military forces. The passage there says that Satan incited him to do it. Satan provoked him to do it. And David did it. And the Lord wasn't happy about that. So I think the seer's name was Gad on that occasion, the prophet, the servant of God. And he came to David and he said, I've got a message for you from the Lord. And basically, is you get to choose your own punishment. What you've done has not been good. So he gave him three choices. 3 years of something, 3 months of something, or 3 days of something. What did David choose? Remember what his statement was? Let me fall into the hands of the Lord and not into the hands of men. Because men, as we've been saying, they can be brutal, cutthroat, bloodthirsty. And I'd rather just take my chances with the Lord. So usually it's a comforting thing to be in His hands, isn't it? He provides, He cares, He does all the things for us that we cannot do for ourselves. But surely we can see, that isn't the context here, to fall into His hands in this way that the author is talking about, that's not even the thought that I want to entertain, because it's just not going to go well at all. Because I know better if I've obeyed the gospel. So down through verse 31, that brings this section to a close in terms of discussing these thoughts that all go together. All right? Any comments, anybody has a question through verse 31? Inescapable. You are correct. You'll just be at the mercy of God. And that's just the phrase. There'll be no mercy extended, but you'll be totally at the disposal of what God will choose to do with you and to you. And that's where you'll be and how sad and tragic that would be. Yes, Brother Lambert, you're going to... Yes. And in fact, as the old statement is, where much has been given, much is required. We ought to know better. Now, here we sit. You know, sometimes we talk about those outside the kingdom who won't obey the gospel, who aren't interested in the truth. They have no desire to learn about the plan of salvation and what to do to be saved and all that business. And we know where they're headed. And we think about that. But I think Brother Lambert's comment is correct. Let's not cut ourselves any more slack than we deserve. We can fall too. And God will judge us. Just because we're in the kingdom doesn't give us a pass or a get out of jail free card, if we borrow the phrase from Monopoly. That's not going to happen. We will face His wrath just the same if we violate the terms of that covenant. Okay. Go ahead. And what else can you say to that person who has said, either with the mouth or with their actions, look, I'm happy and I'm content with where I am, and I'm going to live life the way I want to. Well, what else can you offer such a one? I think that's really one of the main ideas of this passage. You can't say anything else to them. We can certainly pray for them. And I know we do, those who have friends or family who are in this position. But that's all we can do. And still try to reach them if they'll be somewhat open to what we can say to them. But this is a very serious passage. One that needs to be considered in that way. Okay. I think we've pretty much answered all the questions on page 26 going through these charts. I don't see anything on here that we've not talked about that we haven't already covered. So turn to page 27 now. And we'll look at now, start to conclude chapter 10. All right? Now, verses 32, let's just consider all of these together, 32 through 39. Angela, would you read these 8 verses for us, please? Okay. This section, do you get the idea that the author has already given up on these people? Not yet. I was trying to find a passage while she was reading this, and it currently escapes me. I think we've already covered it. We have confidence concerning you, my brethren. Something to that effect, and I can't seem to find it right now. We have better things. Chapter 6, verse 9. Yes, thank you, whoever said that. Good. Thanks, Judy. Yes, but beloved, we are convinced of better things concerning you. So the author has not totally given up yet on these Christians. But he is simply warning them, as he needs to, regarding these things that they're headed, or these things that they're facing if they continue to go where they're headed. Recall the former day. So, back here, when you came to the gospel, when you came to Christ, recall the former days when after you were enlightened, you were taught and you learned what happened to these Christians. All right, they suffered. He said, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, this version says. Or other versions say you endured a great conflict of sufferings. Okay? So that's where they've been in the past. Now, to emphasize that these things don't have to turn out the way that they are, they don't have to go this way. I mean, they will eventuate in this tragedy if they keep going where they're headed, but it doesn't have to work out that way. He reminds them of their past faithfulness. They suffered, yes, but they had endured. They outlasted the suffering. They did not cave into it previously. Notice the two ways he says that they suffered. Look in verse 33. What was the first way they suffered? Okay. Sometimes, or in part, some versions say, in part because you were publicly exposed to reproach and affliction. It wasn't private. You were called out in public. In some way, there was public pressure put upon these Christians. That was one way they suffered. What was the other way they suffered? Verse 33 also. Okay, those who were suffered, who were suffered this way, but maybe some were not, but they suffered because they were associated with Him. Guilt by association is the idea. So whether they themselves personally were reproached, or they were deemed guilty because they had fellowship with those who were personally or publicly reproached. Either way, he says, you had that happen to you in the past. You have gone through that. And it's not stated, but it's strongly implied. How did they hold up under all that pressure? Did they quit? They didn't quit. They made it through that. Okay? Now, verse 34. In this text, verse 34 makes me this is a verse that I think about the most. I think this is very telling to me. Their endurance helped them do what? All right? Not just accept, joyfully accept the plunder or the seizure of their property. Now let's think about this just for a moment. I think all of us here are homeowners. We have our own property. And to own property in this country is a some say that's the American dream. Well, okay. It's to own some land. We call it our own. This is home to us. We can live in peace and quiet. We don't have to worry about getting kicked out. This is our place. But what if someone came to us today and said, you are losing your property because you're a Christian? Not because you didn't pay your mortgage. You're in default, you didn't pay, that's not it, because you're a Christian. And you're losing your home. Now, we may not ever have to face that. We may someday have to face that, but we haven't faced it yet. But I want you to think about the kind of faith it would take to get through such a situation like that. And not just have to walk away from it, but do it how? Joyfully. And what is the only way to endure such harsh treatment joyfully? Here, look at the text. That's right. Verse 34. And you joyfully accepted the plunder or the seizure of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. This isn't it. Many times I think we just sing. And I'm not going to be too critical here, but I think we sing without thinking. This world's not my home. I'm just a passing through. And we don't really consider the force behind those words. Do we really believe that? It's got a nice, catchy, toe-tapping tune to it, but those words mean something. These people did that. That is the only way they could have accepted that joyfully. James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into divers trials and temptations. James chapter 1. And so we need to have that same kind of attitude. And they accepted their loss because they had a better possession. All these passages here, and I think I asked this question. Yes, question 17. Where else in the New Testament is such a hope expressed? These are the verses that I came up with. Maybe you have these or somewhat different ones. What did Jesus teach in Matthew 6, 19 to 21 about treasures? All right. Do not lay for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. You can have the finest home. Well, today's inauguration day and the White House is at the center of attention. Old residents moving out, new residents moving in. And I've been there. Maybe you only been there too. The tour of the White House. It's a fine show place. But what's going to happen to that place one day? It's going to crumble. Either it'll fall down. Either it'll get conquered in war, and that could happen. Okay, but if it never does, one day what's going to happen? It's going to be destroyed. But it's not abiding, so we can't lay up ourselves. And there's a lot of wealth in that house. A lot of valuable pieces of art and a lot of things that are wealth and that are valuable, but it's not going to last. Jesus said, don't lay up yourself treasures on earth, but rather lay up the treasures in heaven where those things cannot happen. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart is also. And these saints understood that. That's why they could accept the plunder of their property joyfully. Colossians 3:1-2, set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. That's how we have to do that. Hebrews 13, we're coming up on this passage rather quickly, but look in verses 13 to 16. The author pauses in discussing some individual people to talk about some general principles here. They did not receive the promises, but they saw them from afar and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were only strangers and exiles on the earth, for people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. That makes us think again. We mentioned this in our sermon Sunday morning, looking for a city, up in verse 10 of chapter 11, whose builder and maker has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. In Philippians 3, let's finish with this passage, Philippians the 3rd chapter. The last part of verse 18 through verse 20. Well, let's just read 18 through 20. Freddie, when you have that, Philippians 3, 18 through 20, read that for us, please. All right, particularly there, the last part of verse 19. After describing these enemies of the cross, their end is destruction, their God is their belly, their glory is their shame, and they have their minds set on earthly things. But our citizenship is in heaven, not here. So, a lot of other passages, I'm sure maybe you wrote down a few extra ones other than these, but this idea, whatever you and I may ever lose in this life, we're going to have enough faith. Will we accept it joyfully? In this life, what is the worst thing that can happen to you? You die. That's it. I mean, and they can't do that but just one time. You can't be killed twice or three times. And Jesus said, Matthew 10:28, fear not them that can kill the body but cannot destroy the soul, but rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. So that's how they were able to do this. And so I get the idea. The writer, yes, has been talking very grimly, at least down through verse 31. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of God unprepared. But then these next few verses, I get the idea that he had not given up on these brethren yet. And to emphasize that, they had shown some past faithfulness. They had done good in the past. Again, looking at 34, they had compassion on those in prison and joyfully accepted the plunder of their property. So he's saying, therefore, now the exhortation, verse 35, what does he say? Therefore, do not cast away or throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. You have to have confidence to serve Christ. It's necessary. It has great reward. And he says, we live by faith. Do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance. That's why we've called this section the need for enduring faith. Not just faith, but faith that endures. Faith that doesn't quit. And that's precisely the theme here. Do not quit. Do not go back. Do not walk away from Christ. Do not forsake Him or His covenant. You have need of enduring faith. Verse 36. So that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. Who does he quote in verse 36? Verse 37. Habakkuk. Yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, or if he falls away, what's God say about that? My soul has no pleasure in it. Now let's quickly set the context of why he quoted Habakkuk. What was going on in the book that Habakkuk wrote? Where this quote comes from. Why pull this quote up? You remember? I'm having a hard time hearing this morning. I'm sorry. Habakkuk had some complaints about what he saw in Jerusalem. No justice being upheld, sin rampant everywhere. And so in the first chapter, he takes his complaint to Jehovah and said, what are you going to do about this? Basically, this is what the complaint was. Remember what God said. I'm about to do a thing that if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it. Habakkuk, here's my answer. I'm sending who? The Babylonians. I'm sending the Chaldeans. They're going to be my tool of judgment against Jerusalem against Judah. Well, that's all in the first chapter. How did Habakkuk respond to that? Yeah, they're worse than we are. What do you mean sending the Chaldeans? You can't do that. They're unrighteous. They're evil. They're wicked. You've got to come up with a better plan than that, basically, is what Habakkuk told the Lord. And Jehovah said, well, concerning them, I'll take care of, and it would be specifically in the person of Nebuchadnezzar, I'll take care of him. I'll deal with him. But as for you, and not just you personally, but you, my people, Judah, the Hebrews, how do you have to live? The just shall live by faith. Now that's where that phrase comes from. Paul uses it a lot in the Romans letter. The just shall live by faith, being justified by faith. Okay? So what does that teach us? Well, yes, ma'am. They did. They did. They withstood the fiery furnace and Daniel's den of lions. That's right. They put their faith and trust in God. So when the will of God comes about, or life dishes out some pretty harsh stuff, as it did on that occasion, how does the child of God get through that? What's the temptation to do? Well, to quit. To give up. And you have need of enduring faith. We must not quit. We've got to be faithful. And he quotes Habakkuk. Those who walk away, my soul has no pleasure in them. That's how God feels about that. So that's the lesson to us. Although we're certainly aren't in the time frame of Habakkuk, we weren't alive back then, so that's not directly said to us. Nor are we in the audience of this book directly, living as Jewish Christians in the first century, being tempted to go back to the law. Okay, that doesn't apply to us either. But can we fall away today? We most certainly can. All of us can. And this statement in verse 36. You have need of endurance. All of us individually need to endure. And we've discussed, at least in this chapter, all the practical things that we can do to help ourselves and to help each other to stay faithful. As he said, again, verse 35, do not throw away your confidence, for it has great reward. The only way to get the reward is to live it, and we cannot quit. And you have this quotation from Habakkuk. So, verse 39. But we are not of those who shrink back. Again, Here's an idea where he's not given up on the brethren yet. We're not of that type. And I know you can do better than that. We are not of those who shrink back to destruction and are destroyed, but we are of those who have faith and what? Preserve their souls, is how this version concludes chapter 10. That's who we are. Okay? So the need for enduring faith. They must not shrink back to destruction. Yes, buddy. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You're right. You're right. It's the first step. Someone may say, well, the first step in obeying the gospel, that's the toughest part. Well, really, in truth, it's not. The first step is really the easiest. The real challenge comes when? The next day, and then the next day, and then the next day, all the days after that. And I've always admired what Jesus has said on several occasions when he wants all men to come to him, but he doesn't want to pull the wool over our eyes. He says, look, I want you to know what you're getting yourselves in for. Count the cost, Luke 14. It's costly to be my disciple. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I tell you the truth. So I'm being upfront with you. It's going to be costly to be a disciple. You have need of endurance. It has great reward, but it's going to come at a price. Now, our salvation came at a price, didn't it? His own blood. That was costly. And so let us not get into the mindset that, oh, this is easy. Now, well, stop because our time is up, but just to kind of build a bridge. And I think this is question 19. Bottom of the last page of 27. The next chapter may be the most notable of all the book. Okay? All these examples, and we'll go through all that. But I want you to see how we can bridge from the end of chapter 10 into chapter 11. We're being exhorted to have enduring faith. You have need of endurance. What would be a good way for the Holy Spirit, which I'm convinced He did through the author here, what would be a good way to put a face on that? Give us all kinds of examples, which I think that's exactly what chapter 11 is. Yes, right. Yes. Yes, all through their lives. That's right. They were good servants of God. So, perseverance. Right, yes, right. Not quit. Those are good comments. So, when we start these characters the next week, Lord willing, think about, we read about Noah and Abraham and Moses and David and all these people. We'll talk about their individual situations that differed from the other. I mean, what Moses went through was different than what Noah had to do and Abraham. But the theme that runs through all those is this enduring faith. And that's what I believe the writer is trying to get his readers to see. Look, God has always required His people to be faithful and to abide by what He's taught to get through whatever situations they may have been facing. And that's the lesson to us. So we'll go through these examples, the Lord willing, next Tuesday. Thank you all for coming today, and we'll see you tomorrow night for Bible study.